leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first to cast his ballot in the capital, Tehran, and said the day of elections is a day for the Iranian people that will essentially determine the fate of the country for the coming years. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country needs to get fully prepared for confrontation with the US in order to protect the dignity of the country. Also ahead, Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters marching in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against a controversial settlers rally. Welcome to World News. Thank you very much for joining us. Going to kick off this bulletin with the latest updates on Iran's presidential election. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first to cast his ballot in the capital, Tehran, and made some remarks. He said the day of elections is a day for the Iranian people that will essentially determine the fate of the country for the coming years. He says the day belongs to the people, the election belongs to the people, the people's presence at the polling stations, those casting their ballots will determine their future for several years. He described it as a brave national test. The leader also called on voters to cast their ballots. Even a single vote is of importance, saying, "Don't think nothing is going to happen with just one vote. Every vote counts." And the leader said, as he noted, as he does always, highlights this point, that it's always better to vote as early as possible and not leave it late. More than 59 million people are eligible to cast their ballots in the country's 13th presidential election. The minimum voting age in Iran is 18. The opening and closing times for polling locations inside Iran are 7 a.m. to midnight and can be subjected to a two-hour extension. There will be 67,000 polling stations across Iran, as well as more than 230 in other countries for expatriate voters. Let's cross over to the Ministry of Interior, which plays an important role in the elections. Joining us from there is our correspondent, Yusuf Jalali. Yusuf, welcome. What can you tell us about what's going on at the Ministry of Interior and perhaps, you know, its role in the elections, the 13th presidential election in Iran?
Well, of course, the Interior Ministry is the beating heart of the Iranian election. It is, of course, tasked with monitoring the elections. Every single vote that is cast inside the ballot boxes is monitored and observed and seen from the Interior Ministry here. So where I'm standing is the hall, the main hall of the Interior Ministry, where different officials come here, take to the podium and brief the reporters about the latest developments regarding the election here in Iran. So the polls opened at 7 a.m. local time here in Iran, and the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first people who voted and cast their ballot inside the ballot boxes. I also went there to that venue, to the polling station where the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution cast his ballot. And by casting his ballot, he conveys several messages. The leader conveys several messages. On top of them is his call for high turnout for the Islamic Republic, for the entire political system in Iran. High voter turnout is always a major issue. So that is why many Iranian officials, on top of them, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, also calling for high turnout in this election as well. So I was there, and he, of course, talked to reporters. The leader said that every single vote counts in this country. So he called for high voter participation, and he said that the Iranians should take part in the decision-making process by electing their presidents. As you know, since 4 decades ago, with the establishment of the Islamic Republic, Iran has been holding an average of one election every year. So, and even today, Iranians are not just participating in the presidential vote. They're taking part in four elections at the same time. They're taking part in the presidential vote, in the city and village council vote, the midterm parliamentary election, and the midterm assembly of experts election. So four elections concurrently are being held across the country. So the polls open at 7 a.m. local time here, and will end at 5 p.m. actually local time. And as of every year, as with every year, most probably the votes will be extended until 12 p.m. local time here. At the end of the day, 12 a.m. actually. So that is why we're expecting that this time around, the voting hours will also be extended. And the fact that the elections are being held amid the coronavirus pandemic, different measures have been taken by the authorities, including extending the voting hours until 2 a.m. the following day. And this time, the start of the voting, of course, was an hour ahead of the previous election. So every round of the elections, in every round of the elections, we would see that the elections start at 8 a.m., but this time around it started at 7 a.m., 1 hour earlier. So, and different other measures are being taken by the authorities, including the fact that 30% of the capacities of the polling stations are going to be used for people to stand in queues and cast their ballots. And this time, stamps are not used in the election. So people, instead of the ordinary classical ways of authentication processes, online authentication processes are being used right now across the country. So to avoid touching the stamps and for the fingerprints and the authentication process. So this is a very different election, given the fact that this time it's not an election that is a competition between or rivalry between different political parties. This time around, it's a contest of plans. Those stand a better chance to win the election that have offered during their campaigns a better plan, a viable roadmap for fixing the Iranian economy. This time around, the focus of the election is not on the political parties. So in previous presidential elections, you would see that people are distracted by the fact that their favorite nominee or their favorite candidate has to be coming from their favorite, of course, political party. But this time around, this is not the case. People want a change, a real economic change for their country.
Great stuff, Yusuf. Thank you very much indeed. Yusuf Jalali there, our correspondent, joining us from the Ministry of Interior here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thanks a lot, Yusuf. Thank you. Now, it's not just Iranians in Iran that are casting their ballots. Iranian expats outside the country are also casting their ballots across the globe, from the United Kingdom to Lebanon to Afghanistan. And it's Afghanistan where we're going to go to now, here at the Afghan capital, Kabul, joined there by our correspondent, Amin Alami, for more on that. Amin, welcome. You're at a... Tell us firstly where you are and what's the voter turnout there and what you're seeing, who have you spoken to as well?
Well, currently I'm at the Iranian embassy here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. As I talked to officials here at the Iranian embassy, dozens of Iranian citizens have so far came to this embassy and cast their ballots. As they say, the voting program is going to be go on till 6 p.m. local time here. But in the meantime, given security threats are high, Afghan Interior Ministry have deployed a number of security forces around the embassy here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Many routes are blocked, and only Iranian individuals or Iranian citizens are allowed to enter to Iranian embassy to cast their ballots. I also talked to Iranian ambassador here, Dr. Bahadur Aminyan. He widely welcomed the presence of Iranian citizens at the Iranian embassy for casting their ballots, and said that they support the democratic system in their country and support their own country as well. As he said, that this move is to strengthen the unity of Iranian nation inside Iran as well as abroad, mainly in the Afghan capital Kabul. This is also worth mentioning that only the staff of Iranian embassy are not those who are attending, who are casting their ballots. Many other Iranians, including the workers of UN bodies and many other international organizations or NGOs who are stationed in Afghanistan, have come here in Kabul to cast their ballots. In the meantime, according to local sources in Jalalabad, the capital city of Eastern Nangarhar province of Afghanistan, many Iranian citizens, mainly the staff of the Iranian consulate in Jalalabad, have also come here in the Afghan capital Kabul to cast their ballots.
Okay, Amin, thank you very much indeed for that. Amin Alami there, our correspondent in the Afghan capital Kabul, joining us from the Iranian embassy, where Iranian expats in Afghanistan are casting their ballots for the next president of the country. Now, Iran's chief negotiator Abbas Araghchi says talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement have come closer than ever to fruition. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Araghchi noted that some essential issues are still being negotiated. He said Tehran wants to make sure that the United States will not repeat its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal with Iran. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his U.S. counterpart that he expects Washington to fully return to the accord known as the JCPOA. Iran, along with the European Union and six world powers, thrashed out the landmark agreement in 2015 after years of negotiations. However, the U.S. pulled out of the deal in 2018, reimposing sanctions on Iran. Tehran says it wants all sanctions removed in a verifiable manner. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country needs to prepare for both dialogue and confrontation with the United States under President Joe Biden. In remarks during the meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, Kim outlined his strategy for relations with Washington. He stressed that Pyongyang needs to get fully prepared for confrontation in order to protect the dignity of the country. North Korea has already accused the Biden of pursuing a, quote, hostile policy. Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, made headlines but little diplomatic progress with a series of face-to-face meetings with Kim. Biden says he will not pursue that policy unless North Korea negotiates its nuclear arsenal with a concrete plan. Israeli forces attacked Palestinian protesters in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, arresting a number of people. Palestinians were protesting outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound against a controversial march by Israeli settlers on Tuesday. During the march, Israeli settlers insulted Islam's Prophet Muhammad and chanted death to Arabs under the protection of Israeli forces. The so-called March of Flag also triggered protests in the Gaza Strip, where the resistance groups warned the regime of consequences for allowing such a controversial move. Israel, meanwhile, has carried out airstrikes on the besieged of the Gaza Strip, hitting at least 10 Palestinian targets near the cities of Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun. No casualties have been reported so far. Tel Aviv claims the air raids were in response to Palestinians sending incendiary balloons towards the occupied territories. Also, Palestinian resistance groups have shot down and seized an Israeli drone in the west of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli strikes followed Israel's 11-day aggression against Gaza last month. The conflict ended on May 21st after a ceasefire. Nearly 260 Palestinians, half of them women and children, were killed. Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel in response, killing a dozen people. The UK reports over 11,000 new COVID-19 infections, its highest daily rise in cases in nearly 4 months. Official figures show the number of new deaths has also risen to 19 from 9, reported on Wednesday. The government on Monday announced a decision to delay the lifting of restrictions due to the spread of the new Delta strain first detected in India. Experts are concerned that rising case numbers will turn into death tolls similar to previous waves. Russia has warned that Ukraine's membership of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is a red line for Moscow. Earlier, the Ukrainian president announced that his country will soon be joining the alliance, but his American counterpart said that Kiev needs to meet some criteria before its membership. Here is a report.
For ages, joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has been a long-sought dream for Ukraine. NATO countries have a mutual defense pact, meaning if one nation is attacked, the others will join in their response. By this, Kiev, which has been engaged in a domestic conflict with pro-Russian forces, is seeking to get NATO's help to get rid of the militias. On Monday, the alliance's annual summit in Brussels wrapped up with the release of a joint communique that reaffirmed NATO's 2008 decision for Ukraine to become a member through a Membership Action Plan, or MAP, without setting a timetable. Shortly afterward, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appeared to announce a change on Twitter shortly before U.S. President Joe Biden began a news conference in Brussels where he was attending a NATO summit. He tweeted that NATO leaders confirmed that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance. But NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made it clear that no such action was imminent. Stoltenberg said, "To agree on the membership action plan, you need a consensus among 30 allies. This was the focus of the summit." Biden stressed that Kiev does not have the go-ahead to join NATO. The U.S. president said Ukraine needs to clean up corruption and to meet other criteria before it gets into the action plan. However, he affirmed Washington's support for Ukraine's territorial integrity. Biden also met with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin for the first time in Geneva, Switzerland on Wednesday. The two discussed a number of issues, including resumption of diplomatic ties and the return of expelled envoys, but apparently made no mention of Ukraine's membership in NATO. On Thursday, the Kremlin expressed concern over talks for Ukraine to join the alliance. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Ukraine's NATO membership would be a red line for Moscow, noting that Russia is watching the issue closely. Ukraine has been locked in a tense tug-of-war with pro-Russian forces ever since the Crimean Peninsula rejoined Russia following the ouster of Ukraine's president Viktor Yanukovych in 2014. The conflict on the country's east has killed more than 4,000 people.
And that is an end to our bulletin for this hour.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Policy has been a priority with Iran's outgoing government. A landmark deal was struck early in Hassan Rouhani's 8 years in office. That was the JCPOA, which won't be revived by Iran's June the 18th presidential elections Friday. So, it will be a major challenge the next president will inherit, alongside several other foreign policy challenges. However, each challenge challenge can be transformed into an opportunity of equal weight if handled with the right proportions of recognition, diplomacy, and firmness. What challenges will the next president face besides the 2015 JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal? Which ones ought he prioritize and turn into an opportunity, and how? These are questions we'll be answering with a look at the legacy passed down by the current administration here on Iran Today. Welcome to another election special with me, Leila Faromaz. To begin with, the present administration's pet policy, the JCPOA, was both a milestone achievement and a heavy weight that fell back on the country when the former U.S. administration unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018. Mr. Hassan Beheshtipour is a steadfast believer in that nuclear deal. He joined us on Skype to walk us through the Rouhani era and paint a picture of a future in the hands of any of today's seven presidential candidates.
Mr. Rouhani managed to resolve an international dispute and to put an end to documentations against Iran, which had been ongoing for 12 years by negotiating the JCPOA. This is significant. Some people inside the country indeed believe that the JCPOA didn't bring economic benefits for Iran. But the point is that the most important achievement of the deal was putting an end to the documentations against Tehran's nuclear program. They had made serious accusations against Iran, which, under the deal's so-called past and future issues, ended forever in November 2015 in the Board of Governors. This was a huge achievement. These were the issues that were used to pass six resolutions against Iran and put it under Article 7 of the United Nations Charter, unfairly describing it as a threat to international peace and stability.
So, it will be a major challenge the next president will inherit, one of several foreign policy challenges. If the current government doesn't conclude talks before the new government takes office on August the 3rd, that will likely be a principalist government skeptical of the US and the West. But then, decisions on strategic issues are not ultimately the government's to make alone. The president does chair the Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, and has some influence on its composition. And strategic decisions are often made in a consensual manner, but ultimately they require the approval of the leader of the revolution. Now, in this stage, talks are being facilitated by Europe, or are they? The JCPOA was signed between Iran and the P5 plus one. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. It was to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear program in return for sanctions relief for this country. Trump's America pulled out and made sure that doesn't happen. Iran remains committed in a deal that Western European parties purported to rescue by devising a way around US sanctions and the dollar for trade transactions. That didn't materialize, and today they are simply intermediaries in Vienna talks. But the talks are close to overspilling beyond the Rouhani government's lifespan and its JCPOA partners' golden opportunity. Perhaps Europe's ultimate goal is not to get the JCPOA back on its feet.
Mr. Rouhani invested too heavily in ties with Europe. The Europeans showed that they were powerless in the face of the US monetary hegemony. Because when Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, or in other words, ended his commitments under the deal, the Europeans were unable to uphold the 11-point pledges they had made to Iran. Therefore, one of the mistakes Mr. Rouhani's government made was being over-reliant on the Europeans, who didn't do anything for us. But of course, Europe stood against the US demand for triggering the so-called snapback mechanism, rejecting it with 11 abstained votes. Also, the Europeans abstained from voting for a US proposed draft resolution seeking an indefinite extension to an arms embargo on Iran.
Of course, Europe's approach may not be a determining factor, as US President Biden insists on the continuation of Trump policies as leverage in negotiations. Europe's role is actually one of coordinator, and it is using its capacities to help in pressuring Iran into accepting terms beyond JCPOA demands. That is to control or even scrap this country's defensive ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Two demands Iran finds outrageous and insulting. Iran also does have the opportunity of showing more goodwill by accepting FATF terms and agreeing to return to full compliance with the deal in return for the U.S.'s lifting of only nuclear deal-related sanctions, FATF being the Anti-Money Laundering Financial Action Task Force. But this country feels no obligation because it was the U.S. that pulled out of the deal to begin with, and that was a deal that laid Iran bare to surveillance and sabotage. Talking of turning challenges and problems into opportunities, Iran and Europe have plenty of common interests to consider in matters such as energy, the fight against drugs, the fight against terrorism, and advanced technologies to enjoy. The path to getting there is detente and confidence building that would result in purposeful interaction. But that's enough on a single deal that Iran cast most all of its chips into. There's a world beyond out there. In the absence of a Western alliance, Russia and China have been powerful allies to Iran, even overpoweringly so. By 2019, China had gained control of under 48.5% of Iran's exports and 27.5% of the country's imports. There's no place like home, and it's regional alliances that Iran and its neighbors must recall for their very livelihood in their match against nature itself. Water scarcity paints a scary future when 12 out of the 17 most water-stressed states in the world are in the Middle East and North Africa. Iran and its Arab neighbors to the south must cooperate to promote water security while minimizing harm to the Persian Gulf's ecology. Attention tends to focus on geopolitical challenges and economic exchange, but working together on water might open the way for meaningful cooperation on other issues. Focusing on the usual concerns, however, Mr. Beheshtipour talks of lost time with Saudi Arabia.
Mr. Rouhani's failure included Iran's relations with Saudi Arabia. Of course, those who stormed the Saudi embassy and set it on fire were responsible for the strained relations, but Mr. Rouhani was unable to improve the ties afterward. This continued until recently before negotiations with Saudi Arabia kicked off. We hope the talks are successful, because resolving the problems between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have a considerable impact on ending the devastating war on Yemen. It will also leave a positive impact on Iraq's stability and security.
While we're on the subject of neighbors, the current government got to enhance ties with Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And it's got to solve some problems with its Azerbaijan ties, as well as differences in relation to Turkmenistan and the purchase of gas. Our analyst awarded Rouhani and his foreign policy team that praise, but said how balance must be maintained henceforth. The sum of it all sketches a close-up of Iran in total, its situation and status on the world scene. Geopolitics are a determining factor. Iran is the bridge between East and West, and any government can make the most of this natural positioning if it plays its cards right.
Another important point about Iran is its population. Iran is a country of over 80 million. Its people are highly educated. Its youth have excellent abilities and have shown them in different historic projects, like a nuclear program. They are self-reliant and have been able to do a lot. Therefore, Iran has the capacity to produce knowledge. It has the power of its population. It has economic power.
Ultimately, to our guests, the most important political game now is the challenge and opportunity that is the very JCPOA. Iran can live without it, but should it come to an agreement over that nuclear deal, it will have found a well-designed pattern for international exchanges. And those will facilitate better utilization of domestic capacities even. Whatever plans the different candidates have for different economic issues would make or break them in the presidential race. Issues are inflation, poverty, unemployment, and skyrocketing prices for basic household goods. Principalists or conservatives blame problems on the Rouhani administration's looking to the West to solve the country's economic woes. The question today is, what will they, the candidates, bring to the table? Dr. Shaghavi is Dean of Khwarazmi University's Faculty of Economy. He came to share his views with us at Press TV Studios.
Have
Any cabinet that will take office would face these problems and challenges, which have escalated compared to the previous decade. As time passes by, the problems worsen. Another point to mention is that all the think tanks are predicting by 2030 no country would buy oil. This means an end to the oil exports era.
Dr. Rachfat is an economist teaching at Al Zahra University, where we met him. He mentions the main reason for a high inflation rate.
The main reason behind the rise of inflation in Iran is what's called the costs push, which is mainly caused by currency manipulation. Iran's inflation has ranged somewhere about 14 to 15% when there haven't been wide fluctuations in the value of our national currency. But in the past 8 years, the inflation in Iran averaged 24%. The highest inflation level was recorded last year at 50%. It was mainly caused by the devaluation of the national currency, as I just mentioned.
Hassan Rouhani didn't inherit a bed of roses when he started out as president in 2013. International sanctions had been tightened in 2011, and inflation was at over 30%, and there appeared no way out but to negotiate a deal with the world's economic powers. That would be the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal with the P5 plus one, the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. They would lift the UN's nuclear-related economic sanctions off this country in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. The US pulled out, however, in 2018 and made things worse for this country.
The 11th government took office with a promise to solve Iran's nuclear-related issues, lift sanctions, and improve the country's international ties. But the nuclear negotiations that were expected to be wrapped up fast took about 2 to 2.5 years to conclude. Even after JCPOA was reached, several issues, including banking relations, were left unsolved. The government put all its eggs in the basket of the nuclear deal.
Although it may not be tangible, the Rouhani government is said to have kept the economy afloat when it could have actually drowned by U.S. sanctions, the oil revenues frozen abroad, and the COVID-19 pandemic. Not sure our Dr. Rachfat agrees.
It appears to me that we have all the resources to fund the public sector, but there isn't a political will to get that done. The fact that the government hasn't turned to taxes and that Iran's tax system is flawed and inefficient depends on how much they fit the interests of the decision makers.
Now, Iran's problem is indeed also corruption and mismanagement, not just external sanctions. Whatever weakness or malice and vice the government may have, it is not the ultimate force in the country to carry all the blame. The government needs tax revenues it cannot extract from the most powerful institutions or invisible incomes. It attempted selling bonds for public companies and enterprises, but those basically didn't land in the palms of actual private companies and investors to get the industry running and so create jobs. Dr. Hakhshanas is a prominent economist who was, for his tireless capability, appointed governor of Golestan province when floods swept over the country in 2019. He joined us on Skype.
What the incumbent administration did was, instead of borrowing from the central bank and injecting stronger money into the economy, it attempted to address the budget deficit by selling treasury bills or other securities worth 200 trillion tumans. If the government didn't take this initiative, Iran's economy could sink into hyperinflation, as many experts were predicting following Donald Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018.
Plenty of solutions suggested by economists, but do any plans and ideas put forth by presidential candidates read with those solutions to economic woes? Let's hear it from an expert. Have you seen any concrete economic plans by the presidential candidates?
I haven't seen any candidate with a comprehensive plan so far. I don't know if they have a plan, but they are yet to publish their agenda through the media or on their websites. The plans have to incorporate the priorities, including doors for reforms, operations, how to address major challenges, their quantifiable goals, approaches, and strategies. You see a team of doctors must have a plan that identifies the challenges facing the patient, prioritize which ones to address first, and determines the necessary treatment.
It's come to that time when any guess as to who the next president is can be second-guessed, when the expected outcome can make a U-turn. That's because electoral debates are underway. The first round was on Saturday, the 5th of June, and that was the economic round when candidates could have recreated their destinies. Overall, the debate between the seven candidates wasn't impressive. Although the seven were to respond to predetermined questions, they basically seized the opportunity to respond to criticisms and attack one another and the outgoing Rouhani administration, or to promote their own plans.
We need to do things like levying taxes on non-productive jobs and at the same time reducing taxes on producers.
When we carefully study the matters, we realize that the government's relationship with the economy and the economies with the people haven't been adjusted. Whenever the government faces a problem, it delves into the pockets of the people.
Dear Iranians, your economic conditions can be improved a lot, but that necessitates reforms that the other candidates can't make, but I have the plan and the ability to do so, dear people.
Unfortunately, in our country, the relevant authorities have become responsible for the protection of foreign currency instead of being responsible for protecting the value of the national currency.
Statistics show that almost 50% of people live below the poverty line. This doesn't befit the honorable people of Iran, that 7 million heads of households don't earn a fixed income and need direct assistance to make a living.
The volume of liquidity is more than 3,500 trillion tomans. This is brought about by banks producing money without the supervision of the central bank, creating super debtors. Currently, there are 11 super debtors who owe the economy 90 trillion tomans.
Before making plans to fight poverty, you need to ensure that you have the attitude for it. Do you have what it takes to fight poverty? One of the problems we have had over the past years has been that the people and the underprivileged haven't been the priority.
But for the better part, the debate circled around criticizing the present government's policies and Abdel Nasser Hemmati's efficiency when chief of the CBI, Central Bank of Iran.
Dear Mr. Hemmati, you have sources to make kingpins for steel, sugar, and cooking oil, but you don't have resources to help the poor. He has destroyed the national currency. Now he's talking about the distribution of poverty. You have distributed poverty.
For instance, Mr. Hemmati said why the FATF hasn't been approved, claiming that you know so much about the issue is why the economy is in the condition it is right now.
Hemmati, for his part, tried to exempt himself from the government's policies, saying Hassan Rouhani lacked economic vision.
First of all, let me say at the outset that I'm not Mr. Rouhani's representative. I was set aside from the central bank because of disagreements I had with Mr. Rouhani. He had the same problem you do. He didn't have economic insight. I urge everyone to consider this. Mr. Raisi said two groups of economists can comment. But if you don't have economic insight, which group do you listen to? It's an issue that's been solved everywhere in the world. Anyone who makes economic decisions must have economic insight.
I asked how Hemmati had won the reputation with many of having kept the inflation and decline of the rial under check against all odds. The many don't include our economist.
In an 8-year period, when Iran saw war, occupation, political coup, and other turning points, only once the national currency fell sixfold. That happened in a 3-year period when Mr. Hemmati was in charge.
Mohsen Mehralizad praised the 8-year performance of the Khatami government, calling his own policies a continuation of that reforms government.
People of Iran, all the statistics and political, social, and historical indicators are a testament to the fact that one government managed to advance the country appropriately toward development by moving slowly, steadily, and logically. That was the reformist government of Sayyid Mohammad Khatami.
As for Saeed Jalili and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, those were the two candidates that focused on introducing their own plans more than the others did. This means they spent less time on attacking fellow candidates.
You need to be able to create jobs, not add employees. This means that your agricultural sector should be able to do this. We checked how much work can be done in the petro-refinery sector, petrochemical, oil and gas projects, and energy consumption optimization. Also in agriculture, fisheries, farms, animal husbandry, and etc. We have transformative plans for each of these.
We've been making plans with the help of revolutionary youth over the past 3 years under the title of Salam Government. I can address the production barriers, structural budgeting, non-repayment of debts, bank debtors, and tax issues.
In saying why he wanted to leave the judiciary for the executive, Mr. Raisi highlighted his fight against corruption, the source of which he said was mostly the executive, which he wants to reconstruct.
During my tenure in the judiciary, I faced numerous cases which are traced back to the executive branch of the government. I mean legal cases of corruption and economic rights. We investigate these cases with a steady perseverance. People know well that I know no borders in dealing with corruption cases, and it's been proved to them that I'm not all talk. I'm a man of my words. It's a key point that today we need to promptly deal with and correct the branch of the government which is producing such cases.
We popped out to see what people on the street were thinking, how attractive they found the candidates and their mottos. We also asked people whether they associated economic problems with sanctions or domestic mismanagement.
The point is that sanctions have become an excuse for mismanagement inside the country. If they select qualified managers with relevant knowledge and expertise to the area of their activity, we won't have the problems that we have today in the country.
I wish there were more severe laws against presidents who simply forget about their campaign slogans as soon as they win the elections. That's my personal idea, though. Because in that case, they will stay in office for 4 or 8 years and just exacerbate the problems.
For me, who is grappling with problems of life every single day, baseless slogans won't do any good. In fact, we've been able to find ways around the sanctions, but unfortunately, mismanagement is still prevalent throughout the country.
Sanctions will not always be like this. Things will work out. Actually, we need to find a way to cope with mismanagement.
Pressure of sanctions is undeniable, but still the country enjoys enough potentials to flourish. The fact of the matter is that we've heard loads of these slogans since many years ago, but it's not enough. A tongue doesn't get things done.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam once said, "If the eye is bathed in tears, Allah will protect its owner from the fire. If the tear flows down the cheek, neither miserliness nor abasement will befall its owner. There is a punishment for everything except the tear, for Allah the Most High forgives the seas of sins through it."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the dialogues and the conversations of the fifth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, that he talks with his companions about social etiquettes. He talks with his companions about how to treat people in the best and most perfect manner, how to treat people according to the laws and the prescriptions of Islam, which have been gifted to humanity by Allah in order to create a perfect society, a utopian society, a society which has no blemishes and has been the goal and the mission of mankind right from the beginning. And I will very humbly say that humanity has not attained that utopian society, and humanity will never attain that utopian society until and unless they implement and inculcate the prescriptions that have been prescribed by Allah. Humanity can try all they can, they will never reach perfection if they do not follow the rules and the commands and the prescriptions given to the one who is the most perfect, the ultimate perfection, Allah. Imam al-Baqir talks in this conversation, in this dialogue with his companion, about some qualities of the Shia, the true followers of Islam, the true followers of the Holy Prophet. Imam al-Baqir says to his companion that these people, the true followers of Islam, the Shia, they perform the prayers and the fasting. So first and foremost, from among all the things, we must be able to keep up our prayers and we must keep up our fasting. Then Imam al-Baqir says that they are truthful in talking. Dear friends, we must always speak the truth. We must always tell the truth. We must not lie. We must not cheat. We must not deceive. We must not gossip. We must not backbite. We must not use obscene language. Be truthful in your talking. Be sincere in your talking. Be honest in your talking. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that you should be so bluntly truthful, so frankly truthful that you hurt good people's feelings. I mean, use some common sense as well, but be truthful in your speaking. And finally, they recite the Quran. One of the things in which truly we are weak is the recitation of the Holy Quran, and furthermore, the contemplation upon the verses of the Holy Quran. Dear friends, the reciting the Quran is one of the forms of spiritual refinement, spiritual progress, spiritual perfection, spiritual purification, the recitation and the contemplation upon the Holy Quran, the very word of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Beautiful words brought to us in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The Quran is not clear what it's referring to, who the role models are, what the stories are. Fabricated ahadith have been given to distract people from the actual messages of the Quran. There's one of the stories, Musa and someone that he learned from. The Quran says, Abdan min ibadina. There's plenty of great lessons there. Now, a person who has presented himself as a scholar, and he was a Jewish scholar, pretended to be a Muslim, is now sharing loads of baloney about what the Quran says. He's introduced all this stuff. His name is Khidr, and they call him Khidr for this reason. He did this, he did that. A whole distraction. When you get to the story of Khidr, or the story of Musa and this person, even someone who wants to look at the Quran and understand from it, the first thing that comes to their mind, Khidr, and all the things you heard about Khidr. Is he alive? Is he not alive? And so on and so forth. Get to the story of the Quran. Who cares if he's alive or he isn't? The Quran has teachings there. The Quran is available, but the teachings are not clear because of everybody's saying different things about it. The words of the Prophet, enough of them are not available. Here and there, yes, some ahadith are there. But it's not enough to form a world view for you that you would be able to clearly understand everything else in light of that. It's in pieces. The methodology that Imam al-Baqir presented to the Muslim Ummah that affected and influenced and was able to preserve and bring closer to the track and tracks of the Holy Prophet, what he laid down as the tracks for believers, the path, the true path, Sirat al-Mustaqim. This methodology was something that brought everyone closer to that path.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.